Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
On Primetime Politics, budget missteps.
Who pays for this latest $50 billion orgy of spending by this costly prime minister?
As liberals sell their newly unveiled budget plan, we talk about concerns being expressed a day after its tabling. Coming up, we will speak to the Business Council of Canada to hear why it thinks the document will discourage business investment in the country. Also,
and I think that there needs to be a renewed commitment towards that and a renewed commitment to partnership.
The AFN says the budget is a win for Canada, but not for Indigenous communities. National Chief Cindy Woodhouse-Nipinak will join the program. And we'll hear why the new disability benefit is disappointing people it's meant to help. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. Liberals spent the day defending their newly tabled budget, defending a plan that invests billions in housing and social programs, lays no path to a balanced budget, and increases revenues in part by taxing more of the capital gains made by wealthier Canadians.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister likes to blame the world for the problems that he caused. He doubled the debt. Doubled the rent, doubled mortgage payments, doubled the needed down payment, and now he's doubling down on the same costly mistakes that have made life unaffordable for Canadians. When will this Prime Minister realize that he's not worth the cost and that repeating the same thing 9 times and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity?
The right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, what the Leader of the Opposition is saying is that he stands with the ultra-wealthy 0.1% in this country, and everyone else is on their own. Because that's what he would do as he slashes programs, as he slashes investments, as he doesn't build the homes necessary, as he doesn't have a plan to fight climate change and create good jobs, as he has stood against affordability measures, as he stands against seniors getting dental care, Mr. Speaker. He is choosing to stand with the ultra-wealthy while we are investing in Canadians and building a stronger future that is fair for everyone.
Well, joining us now is Robert Asselin, Senior Vice President of Policy at the Business Council of Canada. Robert, good to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So listen, Ian, you are already on record as saying that this budget discourages business investment. And this comes at a time when this country continues to struggle, and perhaps more so than ever before, with the issue of productivity. So break that down for us. How does it exactly discourage business investment? Is this all about the capital gains tax?
Yes. What we need at this moment is more investment, more business investment, for us to be more productive in the economy, to raise wages, to raise living standards. And what we have structurally as a problem is those investments. And so when you tax capital, as they did yesterday, you make those investments less likely, people less likely to take risks, to be entrepreneurial, to be innovators, to want to have businesses and grow their businesses. So it's a bad signal at a moment where we need business investments.
Yeah, and to break that down a little bit, because I business leaders, think tanks, we yes. always use the term productivity, but ultimately it is what you talked about, a standard of living, making sure what, that the next generation is not poorer than the current generation?
Exactly. It's at the core of the social contract that we have as a country. So to produce more with less effort, that's being more productive, and that's how you grow an economy. And in Canada, we've had this structural problem for a long time, and so we need more innovation, we need more capital being invested, you need a climate investment that is conducive of capital formation. And so unfortunately, measures like today, in the budget won't help.
Okay, except that when you hear it from the government, and it's in their budget document, it's in the interviews that they're giving. Yeah. They say that this capital gains tax, it's newly stated inclusion rate, that it's going to affect less than 1% of Canadians. In fact, they say it will only affect 0.13% of Canadians. So how can this one policy have such a chilling effect when the people affected by it is such a minority in terms of a raw number?
I'm not fond of the class war rhetoric from politicians. What is important is each dollar wanting to be invested in the economy is an important one for Canadians. At the end, this is what matters for their wages, for their living standards. If people don't invest in the Canadian economy, we won't be able to pay for all the things that we have, the social programs that we cherish. So as governments, as policymakers, we want to encourage investments. We want to make the private sector a partner in growing this country forward and moving this country forward.
So instead of a capital gains tax and expanding its inclusion, because that's essentially what we're talking about here, what would you have liked to have seen instead? Because ultimately, this government still wants to move forward with social programs and is being asked to move on issues like housing, making things more affordable. Right. So what could have been in its place, do you think?
They're going to spend $57 billion over 5 years. The easiest thing that could have been done was spend a bit less. Understanding governments spend money on a regular basis and they need to do things. But what is important is focus on the growth side of the ledger so the government has more revenues to fund what it has to fund. And so you can keep this imbalance, keep growing a structural deficit that eventually will be paid by future generations. So what you're doing is you're affecting more of your revenues as a government to service your debt. We're gonna have 10 cents on every dollar now just affected to pay the interest on our debt. You don't want that number to grow indefinitely, because at one point it constrains you to do what you need to do and the stuff that we need to build as a country. The other thing I will say, I think it's a powerful image. Next year, every dollar that will be collected for Canadians on GST from Canadians will be affected to debt services charge, $54 billion. You know, so that's not a sustainable path going forward. We need more growth, a bit less spending, more controlled spending, so that we can preserve what we cherish as Canadians, and those are the social programs that we're very proud as a country.
And let me put to you what I heard from the finance minister last night, though, because from Chrystia Freeland, she argues that, yes, this is not a balanced budget. Yes, there is no path to balance. But ultimately, what she's more concerned about is what she considers a responsible budget. And in this budget, the Liberals argue that they are investing in Canadians, making the investments that Canadians want, but at the same time, by keeping with their own financial guardrails, eventually getting to deficit spending 1% of GDP, they're giving certainty to the market and maintaining Canada's AAA credit rating. So to her, what is in front of Parliament right now is already responsible without necessarily creating the cuts that you're talking about.
I think a tax and spend budget in a shell game kind of fiscal framework is not the way that is sustainable for public finances in this country. You want to grow revenue with a strong, dynamic economy. Not the best way to do this is by raising taxes on businesses, on people who want to take these risks. And then a structural spending that keeps going higher, again, in the higher interest rate environment, that constrain you on whatever else you want to do because you have to service a debt that is growing faster than the economy. That's what people need to understand. And so we're not saying no spending at all. What I'm saying is you have to spend on the stuff that'll make our economy more productive. Of course, you need to help people who need help. That's at the core of who we are as a country. But you have to do it in a much more constrained way that they've been doing in the last 4 or 5 years.
I'm quickly losing time, but I do want to ask you this, because you mentioned the social contract. Is there not a social contract obligation on those who are wealthier than others to pay more, which is essentially the argument of this capital gains tax?
Yeah, but the problem is you're kind of penalizing success. You're saying that making money in a capitalist economy is a bad thing. We need capital again. We need more of it for our economy to grow, for people to be employed, to benefit from higher wages, higher living standards. If our thinking is economic success is bad. People who are successful in, with their businesses is a bad thing. As a country, we're going to suffer. We're going to become a poorer country, and I don't think that's what Canadians want.
But Ezra, I always appreciate the insights. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, time now for a look at what else happened in politics today.
I now ask the Sergeant-at-Arms to admit Mr. Firth at the bar of the House.
The House of Commons admonished a private citizen today in a rare use of its power. Christian Firth, a GC Strategies partner who worked on the ArriveCan app, appeared before the bar of the House of Commons this afternoon. Already found in contempt of Parliament, Speaker Greg Fergus reprimanded him for not answering direct questions while testifying last month at a Commons committee.
Mr. Christian Firth, please remain standing until I invite you to be seated. You are attending the bar of the House for being found in contempt, for your refusal to answer certain questions, and for prevaricating in your answers to other questions before the Standing Committee on Government Operations and Estimates. For all these reasons, on behalf of the House of Commons, I admonish you.
Fergus also ordered Firth to stay and answer questions from MPs, but the governing Liberals tried to delay the session by raising concerns about Firth's mental health and his ability to handle the stress.
On this side of the House, we do not believe that it is appropriate to question Mr. Firth if he is not medically able to participate. We want this to be done in a way that respects the dignity of Parliament. And forcing someone against medical advice to do something that a doctor believes could harm their treatment and recovery is indeed beneath the dignity of this place.
Now, that attempt ultimately failed, and Firth remained in the chamber with the Liberals refusing to question him.
The procurement watchdog found numerous examples where GC Strategies, quote, had simply copied and pasted, end quote, information to prove the people GC Strategies found to do work on ArriveCan actually did it. Question, has the government asked GC Strategies to repay the money paid to GC Strategies for ArriveCan?
Mr. Firth.
Mr. Speaker, the numbers that were provided by the Ombudsman from Public Works, we found were inaccurate when we did our assessments. And secondly, we have not been asked to pay any money back.
Mr. Speaker, given that Mr. Firth is now brought before the bar of Parliament for only the second time in our country's history, given the grave concerns of Canadians, I wonder if there's anything that he would have done differently in his initial committee appearances to avoid the situation he now finds himself in.
Mr. Firth.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely. I would have answered the questions more concisely, taken more time in giving the questions, sorry, the answers, and putting all written information back to the committee faster.
The last time the House questioned a person who was not an MP was in 1913. The Assembly of First Nations also gave its assessment of the federal budget today. It did include $9 billion to address Indigenous priorities like health, economic growth, plus child and family services. But when it came to Indigenous housing and infrastructure, the government is committing $918 million over 5 years, which comes nowhere near the $349 billion that's needed to close the funding gap between Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities.
I think rightfully, people are questioning how we're going to close that infrastructure gap. That is it's the first time we've ever had a number for the infrastructure gap, and in fact, it was through the leadership of me and the Prime Minister that supported the AFN and other Indigenous bodies to quantify what that is. Now we know what the number is. It's giant. $380 billion roughly for First Nations, another $50-60 billion if you're counting Inuit and Métis priorities. And so the work that we're doing both on the investment side, but also on the looking for more rapid creative solution side, I think is critically important.
Well, we're now joined by the Assembly of First Nations National Chief, Cindy Woodhouse-Nipinaka. National Chief, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Now, you had a news conference today, and you told reporters that the budget, quote, falls far short of closing the infrastructure gap for First Nations communities. $918 million has been promised over the next 5 years. What exactly were you hoping for?
Well, certainly, you know, we heard from the Auditor General a couple of weeks ago. We've also just finished a report with Indigenous Services Canada, and it shows that we need a large investment to close the infrastructure gap on First Nations across Canada. And this, so we're glad for, you know, a small part of this being invested in, but we need much more investment, and we are going to always need investments every single budget to close this infrastructure gap to 2030. This falls far off topic, off the track, so to speak, up to 2030. And I think that we need to get back on track. And I know that things are announced for territories, for provinces, but that leaves out First Nations people and it leaves out First Nations communities. So that's good for the whole country when things are, you know, are invested out there from this government, but they have to remember that First Nations are very specific. And when there's announcements for provinces would never invest in First Nations communities.
Mm-hmm. And just so for people at home, so that they understand it, you know, $380 billion is the number quoted in terms of trying to close that infrastructure gap. And the Indigenous Services Minister, she says that her government is still committed to closing that gap by 2030. Do you doubt her sincerity in her saying that?
I don't doubt the sincerity. I think what happens as well sometimes is it's things don't get out fast enough. And I think that we have to begin to find new ways and new processes because the bureaucracy is the way that it is. It doesn't always fit for First Nations. And I think getting those investments out a lot quicker would be helpful in closing some of these gaps and building more homes. Particularly also if we'd focus a bit on schools, we haven't done that in some years. And there's schools on these First Nations communities that, you know, some of our communities need new schools. And we need schools to be renovated that are there. So we have a lot of work to do together. And I think if this country really wants to make the relationship work with First Nations people, it's going to have to take into consideration the experts, our leadership and First Nations on the ground on getting to better results. Mm-hmm. Because you can, you know, if it's a system that's not working, you know, we're seeing it. And the Auditor General has stated that in her report. But I think that when we make these investments, making sure they actually get out the door instead of into departments that don't know, you know, that some of them, maybe some of the bureaucrats in some of those departments have never been to our First Nations communities. So how would they know how things work? And, you know, I encourage them to come out to the communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, it's interesting because as you say that, I'm thinking of another criticism that you shared, because you're not happy about the lack of consultation that happened with First Nations on this budget. And really, that type of consultation and even the funding, getting the money directly out that you're talking about just now, that's not normally how things work. So looking through the lens of reconciliation, how do you see future budgets, future investments being determined and sent out?
Well, they have to, I think, we should start talking now for next year's budget, even for the fall economic statement that will happen in the fall, and then the budget 2025, that we start working and talking about it now, going through the reports that are in front of them. I know that these two reports that I'm talking about were very recent. I know the Auditor General's report was a couple of weeks ago. And of course, our report, with Indigenous Services Canada on housing and infrastructure was just completed a week ago. Let's start from that point and figure out how to make, an impact next federal budget. We're here to work. We're here to listen. We're here to provide advice and support.
Well, it provides advice, support. In fact, to my understanding, you are right now asking for a meeting with the Prime Minister, with the Finance Minister. What exactly are you hoping to accomplish with those meetings?
Well, exactly that, right? Talk about these recent reports, talk about having reconciliation action, making sure that things move forward and working in a better way and finding maybe new policies that will work rather than pushing us into a box and keeping things status quo. We have to think outside the box to make more of an impact on the ground. And, you know, there's some communities out there, for instance, that don't even have cell service. For average Canadians, we're in cities, we could take it, you know, we kind of take advantage of all that or don't even think that it's an issue. But in some of these communities, they don't even have access to that. So stuff like telehealth or, going to university online to do your course from home wouldn't be an option for some of these communities.
A lot of work to do, as you say. But, you know, it's also interesting because as you talk about these priorities, this government has maybe about 18 months left before another election. Does that timeline concern you about trying to get your priorities listened to?
Absolutely. I mean, we will be reaching out to other political parties. We have already, in fact, and so with Pierre and with Jagmeet, and we will continue to do that and to, talk about, give them our submission. And before the next federal election, you know, we are working on an election plan that we will give out to all political parties, that if you want to work with First Nations, here's some good options. Come and partner with us, talk to us, work with our people.
Cindy Woodhouse, always appreciate your time. Thank you for this. As you heard here last night, the NDP is withholding its approval of the budget until Jagmeet Singh can speak with the Prime Minister about a few concerns. Among them, the new Canada Disability Benefit. It is an item New Democrats have called for, but as unveiled yesterday, would only provide about $200 a month for those who qualify. But the minister responsible says the money is meant to help, not pay for everything.
We really want to make sure that this benefit is an income supplement, not an income replacement. We're going to continue to work with provinces and territories to make sure that that's a reality. This is one of the key benefits that our government has put forward. For the first time ever, there is a key statutory benefit that exists in Canada, disability
Will
benefit.
You increase it? Will
we're
going
to continue.
We're going to continue
to work with the disability community and advocates, as well as provinces and territories, who also have their responsibility to make sure that we lift those individuals out of poverty.
Do you think $200?
Well, joining us now is Michelle Hewitt. She co-chairs the group Disability Without Poverty. Ms. Hewitt, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me and my dog Leo, who's with us as well today.
Absolutely. A bit off camera, but you do have your dog Leo with you. Listen, I want to begin with the statement that you put out with your group, because in it you say that this benefit is too little for too few. What exactly do you mean by that?
Yeah, so in the budget yesterday, it was announced that the Canada Disability Benefit will start to be paid out, hopefully by July next year, which could also be too late, would be another thing to add to that. But it's going to have a maximum of $2,400 a year, so $200 a month. Maximum. So that's the too little. The aim of this bill, of this legislation, was to lift disabled people out of poverty. $200 does not lift any disabled person out of poverty that currently needs a provincial or territorial welfare assistance payment to live on. All of those are far too low. Too little is that this now formalizes what we'd long heard as a rumor, which is the disability tax credit is going to be used as the vehicle to deliver it. And currently, in the age range that this benefit is intended for, working-aged disabled people, there are 300,000 people on the disability tax credit out of a total amount of that we think is around 1.5 million people who live in poverty in that bracket. So 300,000 people, the government said in the budget documents yesterday that they intend to double that to 600,000, and they've set out a mechanism that they think will make that happen. But that still is less than half of the people who should be receiving this benefit when it eventually happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's break that down a little bit, because, you know, there are two layers there. But let's begin first and foremost with the amount. And as you say, roughly it will work out to about $200 a month. But, you know, the federal government, you just heard Kamal Khera, the minister responsible for this portfolio, she echoes what we have been hearing, that the federal government believes this benefit is essentially meant to supplement provincial and territorial disability benefits, not replace them. So how would you respond to that kind of pushback?
So currently, there is no provincial territorial benefit that lifts disabled people above what's known as the deep poverty threshold line. So that's roughly two-thirds of the poverty line. The intent of this bill, yes, was to supplement those provincial and territorial payments. But if the gap between where those payments are at and the poverty line is so great, and the government set out to lift people out of poverty, the lifting has to be heavier. It has to be more than $200 a month.
So how much money do you think this benefit should have been? If it's meant to lift people above the poverty line, what exactly are you looking at as a dollar figure?
Well, I come from BC. The poverty line in Vancouver is roughly $2,300 a month. BC currently has a disability assistance payment of just over $1,400 a month. So there's a $900 gap there, of which we just had $200 put to it. If I think about the people in New Brunswick, their current assistance payment is $786. So that takes them to $986. And if you're the poverty line there is somewhere around $1,800, $1,900 a month. They're living currently at half, and this still isn't lifting them to anywhere near there.
Now, the other issue that you raise has to do with the disability tax credit, because that is the vehicle, it seems, through which this benefit's going to be distributed. A certificate is needed for that. There is a $243 million rather, set aside for medical forms to help people apply for it. Does that help alleviate any of the concerns that you initially raised?
So the disability tax credit is a very complex issue for disabled people, and particularly those living in poverty. First of all, it's a tax credit. If you live in poverty, you're not paying any taxes, it's not refundable, you don't have any need for a tax credit. So most people in poverty at the moment don't see much need to apply for it, particularly as one of the things that the government's actions gets to, you do need a medical, and the current rate is anywhere from $150 to $250 to have that form filled in, which the money that you talk to, it's going to go towards paying doctors to sign those forms. But I understand here in Ontario that there are 2 million people without a doctor. In BC, it's 1 in 5. There's 1 million people, and I'm afraid I don't know the figures across the country. But we have a massive shortage of doctors. So it's not just who are you going to pay to fill the form in. It's do you have somebody who knows your medical history enough to pay it in? And as we just said, most of these people have already got a provincial or territorial payment. They've already jumped through these hoops. They've already shared their personal information enough times. Those hoops should be sufficient. So rather than putting money to one side to pay doctors, to fill in forms, given the workload that our doctors that we do have, it's not that they're desperate to be filling the forms in, we should be looking to make this efficient and streamlined and make it work for the people that it's intended for. Make it the benefit them. And so that we really should be looking for this to go straight into their pockets by going from their provincial information, going straight through to the CRA so that they automatically are on that disability tax credit list.
Well, as you know, the NDP leader says he's not yet willing to commit to the budget until issues like the disability benefit are actually addressed. I know that you're in the nation's capital for a couple more days, so we look forward to an update on all of this. Michelle Hewitt, thank you for the time.
Thank you so much, Michael. I appreciate your time.
And that is our program for this Wednesday evening. I'm Michael Serapio. For everyone here at CPAC, thank you for watching Primetime Politics. We'll be back tomorrow night. We'll see you then.